Welcome to the Mind Money Spectrum podcast, where your hosts, Aaron Ogti and Trishul Patel, go beyond traditional finance questions to help you explore how to use your money to achieve the freedom you want in life.
In this episode, Trishul and Aaron discuss the risks and rewards of potential investments across various asset allocation decisions. They cover cash, bonds, stocks, options, and other even more exotic instruments. What are the two variables that determine the risk-return profile of a bond? And where do small-cap and international stocks fit into the big picture? And what about the idiosyncratic risk of a single stock versus a diversified basket? If you understand these various risks and rewards, how do you then figure out what is appropriate for your specific situation? And now, on to our conversation.
Hi, my name is Aaron Ogti. I'm a financial advisor in the Bay Area, and I'm here with Trishul Patel, a wealth manager on the East Coast.
Hey, Aaron, great to be here today, and thanks everybody for listening.
Great to be here as well. We're looking forward to our conversation today. The last couple of weeks, we've been talking about investment strategies. We did investment and especially academic research a couple weeks ago. Last week, we talked about some of the implementation. And one of the big things that we've stressed, especially from academic research and implementation over the last generation or so, has been how important asset allocation is. At a very, very high level, this is usually your mixture between stocks and bonds. Just the idea that if you are not 100% stocks, you start adding bonds to your portfolio, you can start to reduce the risk that you're taking on. But just simplifying it to stocks and bonds doesn't really help clients in putting together investment strategies. It's a little more complex, a little more nuanced than that. So today, we're going to try and describe different investments, different securities, and different types of asset classes that you could invest in, and discuss them on a risk-return spectrum. So kind of starting with the safest asset classes, moving up to the riskiest, and you can start to understand, as you combine these different asset classes, these different types of investments, how does that impact your overall allocation? So we'll start off the safe end, and I usually like to just describe it as cash, just the money in your checking account, the money in your savings account at a bank. But Trishul, when you think of the safest investments, what is the first thing that you describe to clients?
Well, to begin, good introduction, Aaron. I think you laid some pretty good groundwork there on what this conversation is and how it's potentially going to evolve. Well, one thing I also want to stress is, just before we get going on the safest investment, just the notion that we've been trying to put forward is this kind of adage that it's not about timing the market, but it's about time in the market. But really what that tries to say is it's about just putting your money to work as efficiently as possible. And something we noted in an episode or two ago is that the determining factor of how well you do with investing your money is not going to be which particular investments you put your money into, but more so which asset classes you end up allocating to. So that's why this conversation, I think, is so important. So to begin, when I think about stocks and bonds and the various spectrums of risky to less risky, we do think about cash. And then I typically think about my checking account. That's where money goes in from my former paycheck. And that's where money gets thrown around to the other buckets. And personally, my checking account in a past, for most of my history, has been earning close to nothing. I don't know if that's been true for you, Aaron.
I have sometimes gotten all the way up to like 0.01%, I've seen. Like I know I'm getting interest because I get a 1099 interest from my bank, but I don't know how much is on my, you know what? That's probably my savings account now that you say that. I'm probably getting no interest on my checking for probably 10 plus years now that I think about it.
Right. So essentially what that means is you may have a free checking account, but the money in your checking account is just losing money every year due to inflation eating away.
Yep. So I do like your additional caveat that when we talk about time in the market, most people, it's kind of money sitting in their checking account and they're deciding what to do with it. And like, when do I put it in the stock market? But we're going to try and inform asset allocation as well. If it's long-term, it doesn't matter what time you get in because it's going to be years. But if it's shorter term, that's your decision. That's okay to leave in your checking. That's not the absence of a decision. You are choosing to leave it in your safest investment strategy, your safest asset class.
Right. And it's safe because it's actually insured. So there's something known as FDIC insurance, where it's actually backed by the government. I believe it's $250,000 per account per institution. So what that means is if you have an account and then if you have another joint account with your wife at Bank A, that's $250 across each. So $500 total.
I believe it is $250 per registration per institution. So you could have a husband's account gets $250 of insurance, the wife's account gets $250, and then their joint account combined also gets $250. So you could theoretically do that for each institution. You could also even do a trust account. So it's, if you're really, really concerned about this FDIC insurance, it's possible to use that fact of different registrations to get the coverage pretty high. And again, it's per institution. So you just open up those three or four accounts at one bank and open up three or four accounts at another. And all of a sudden you have a couple million dollars that's FDIC insured.
Right. And some of the newer things that have come online are various cash management programs where, for example, with my clients, we have one through MyMax Interest. And what that kind of does is you set a level of cash you want to maintain, and anything above that level gets swept away to a bank that's offering higher interest rates. So that, okay, that kind of helps take care of some of these concerns of just getting nothing on your cash. Again, the interest rates aren't great, but instead of zero, you might be, you know, now it might be close to 1%, something like that.
I think a few years ago it might have been 1%, but right now with short term, the Fed funds rate so low, I think most things are extremely low in terms of anything that has a $1 par value is going to be no interest at this time, or extremely small.
Yeah, we're certainly dig into how rates have been incredibly compressed. For whatever it's worth, their MyMax Interest website is saying up to 1% right now.
Okay, up to 1%. So we're not surprised. Maybe there's a CD or something that has a time limit to it.
That might be true. So what they try to do is they try to cap out the first 250 at the highest, and then they go for the next lowest and so on. So that's kind of what they try to do. But it's not like you're going to be guaranteed this amount for the entire year. It could fluctuate and go down. Okay. But it turns out to be a little better than what you could do if you tried to shop around on your own and move money every few days. So it helps.
Okay. Sometimes when it comes to – so within the – really safe area, things I would kind of see are just your checking account that is FDIC insured, no interest, doesn't go up, doesn't go down. You can never lose value in your checking account in terms of nominal value. You can lose value compared to inflation, but your checking account won't go down. There's no investment risk. You also have things like your savings account could have FDIC insurance there, but you can't have FDIC interest on your checking and your savings. Again, it's kind of per registration, but you will start to get a little interest there. That sometimes savings accounts aren't FDIC insured. So just if it's a big enough bank, then you can depend on the bank being around, but savings accounts will provide some interest. You can start to get into CDs, money markets, and maybe treasuries. So I'm curious, I never thought of actually trying to rank those, but if you had to, and I'm going to make you, between savings accounts, CDs, money market, and treasuries, which these are all super safe, okay? Yeah. You realistically can't lose money with these vehicles. But what would you say is going from safest to least safe, super safe option?
Kind of smiling a bit because these all fall under the category I label crappy. And it's just not a good investment at all. In my mind, it's kind of splitting hairs a little bit. It might be close to nothing compared to almost close to nothing. And the reason I kind of say that is twofold. One is, we mentioned these types of vehicles are meant for liquidity purposes, so I wouldn't really call them investments to begin with. Mm. And the reason I say that is because we mentioned in our episode on debt that the government keeps printing a lot of debt, but it's okay because the amount of debt that they print is sustainable because they get to earn it, or they get to sell that debt at a very low interest rate that's below inflation. So essentially what that turns out for the people selling this debt is they're getting to collect or pay interest at a lower rate than inflation. So the people on the other side of that trade, you know, if we try to save money and we try to invest and earn these rates, we're just going to be getting less real dollars back when we try to go down this route. And then on top of that, the government's going to tax us for getting less money back than we put in. So it's even worse than it sounds. So at the end of the day, what I might just say is you just want to keep your cash balance to a position that's sensible to cover your emergency fund and your short-term needs. And then anything beyond that, you want to think of other vehicles to invest.
I tend to also lump those together. And I don't call them crappy investments. I tend to call them cash. And I tell clients, I don't care what the interest rate is. The only reason we're using cash is because it's not going to go down. That's why we use cash. Whether it's, again, checking, savings, CDs, money markets, whatever you have at your bank. The only thing I care about is that it's not going down. So that is perfect for short-term uses. This would be in a reserve position, emergency or opportunity that you need to access this cash within a week. So your checking account is kind of always being accessed, but if you need to get this money within, say, 3 to 7 days, you just leave it in cash. And for simplicity purposes, I have no problem leaving it in the savings account at the same bank as your checking. I don't necessarily care about shopping around for better rates. I try to point out to clients that if you have $10,000 in cash and you're trying to get an extra 0.1%, trying to go from 0.25 to 0.35, that's $10 over a year. And so if you have $100,000 in cash and you're trying to get that extra 0.1%, that's, again, an extra $100 over the year. Is your time worth that $100? So I tend not to care about the interest rates, but the key for these vehicles is that it's not going to go down. And if the most common large amount I see is a down payment on a house, that it might be, again, a few $100,000. But if you're looking to buy a house in the next year or two, then leave this money in cash. Don't put it at, take on no investment risk. Don't put it in stocks or bonds that can go down. Just leave it alone, and that's okay. And I actually went through this myself, wrote something on my website, how my wife and I sat in cash while the market was up 42% over the span of 3 or 4 years because we were trying to buy a house. And this was the money we were going to use as a down payment on a house. We weren't going to take on any of that investment risk. So I don't feel bad that I missed out on that return because we knew what the money was for. It's okay to leave money in cash when you know what it's going to be for. This could be also like a big tax bill that you know is coming up. You've made great investment decisions. You have this large capital gain that you know you have to pay taxes on next spring. Leave it in cash. Don't take any investment. Don't try and eke out a better return. It's okay to just leave it in cash. I think if I had to make that spectrum, CDs might be slightly safer, but there's a illiquidity aspect that you're leaving it there for a certain amount of time. Money markets are liquid daily, but the rates can fluctuate. Also, the money markets don't have FDIC insurance, and these are funded through various super short-term loans, usually at the corporate or government level. And so it is technically possible to go less than $1. So that's why it's slightly riskier. And we have seen that happen in 2008. It's called money markets broke the buck. So, and a lot of money markets were actually restricting redemptions. It only happened for, I think, a week or so, but technically there is the smallest amount of risk just in the way these money markets are constructed. That's how they can offer better interest rates than your checking or savings. But for all intents and purposes, again, anytime someone has needed this money within months or even a year, the risk is not is so low, I consider it negligible. But that's what I say is the checking savings that have FDIC insurance are, I'd say, are technically the safest. CDs, similar, but you have a time restriction. Then money market might be technically riskier than your checking account. So do you know if the money markets broke the buck anytime before 2008?
No, I don't. But I know some people were concerned. But the other thing to understand is if it's a money market fund, it might be covered by SIPC insurance.
That's true. Yeah. But I don't think, in fact, I'm fairly confident no one lost money in their money market fund. Even when it broke the buck, they restricted redemptions on the variety of money markets I saw and saw clients in, that had their money in, but no one lost money in a money market fund. It was just that one strange period where credit crisis was actually affecting all these short-term debt instruments. But that's how a money market is created. It's a lot of really short-term debt, usually on the scale of 30 days or less, used by corporations and governments, and a money market will kind of combine those to get slightly better yield than an FDIC insured checking or savings account.
Right. And since I did mention the SIPC, the limit for that is 500,000, and that's typically for investments in your brokerage account. Mm-hmm. And I just want to make the distinction that whereas FDIC insurance protects the actual value, the SIPC insurance isn't going to protect the value. Like if you buy IBM and it goes down, it's not going to cover you for that. But it's more for indemnity if the actual broker goes under. So the limits for that is instead of 250, it's 500, and it's similar accounting methodologies on a per account per name basis.
Yeah. So I believe that also might provide some protection against fraud. Like again, it's usually errors either intentionally or unintentionally by the broker, you said. It does not protect against investment losses.
Right.
Okay. So the next level up, so now kind of we're talking about those debt instruments that fund money markets. Again, we're taking on a little bit more risk. We're looking at highly rated bonds. So the highest rate would be U.S. Treasuries. These are backed by the U.S. government because the U.S. government can print money. The way that these debt instruments, so it's the U.S. government is borrowing money and will promise to pay back an interest rate for a certain amount of time. And at the end of that time, they'll pay back the full value. That's usually how bonds work. Because they're constructed that way, technically they could default, but for a U.S. Treasury to default would imply that the entire U.S. government has failed and is defaulting on all of their debt. And while we have seen countries default on debt throughout history and across the world, in our current environment, the world considers the U.S. dollar the strongest currency and kind of the safest investment among government debts. We hear the phrase the U.S. is the world's reserve currency. This means that when, say, France buys oil from Saudi Arabia, they aren't necessarily paying in euros. Saudi Arabia might request that France buys that in U.S. dollars. So U.S. dollars is the world's reserve currency, meaning that different countries or organizations within different countries can use the U.S. dollar to process their transactions. And so that is another implication that the world considers the U.S. government and the U.S. dollar the safest government debt. So that's why I say treasuries are probably slightly riskier. But again, if we're thinking about these super, super small risks, the checking and savings account have the FDIC insurance, which is also backed by the U.S. government. So for most intents and purposes, U.S. treasuries are as safe as checking and savings accounts. The reason I'd put them one level higher is because of interest rate effects. They actually can go up and down, can go up and down differently, or the interest rates can change. Like I know in 2008, U.S. treasuries were the highest performing asset class. I believe they got over 10% return on U.S. treasuries as people kept buying them more and more and driving them up. Do you have any quick comments on, I don't know if it's considered volatility, but the riskiness of U.S. treasuries?
Well, the treasuries are marked in different durations. So on the shorter term, you have instruments that can last a month, and then 3 months, 6 months, a year. And then on the middle term, 3, 4, 5, 6, up to 10 years. And then on the longer term, you might have treasuries all the way up to 30 years. And typically how this works is, the longer the duration of the treasury, the higher interest rate that you'll likely earn, because you're basically locking your money up for a longer period of time. So there's a certain level of reward for having that longer duration. And typically what we see now with that yield curve, the movement of yields as the duration increases, is that on the shorter end, you have rates that are pretty small. The 1 year treasury is about 0.33%. So that's probably the interest rate that you'll get at, you know, some of these CD options, or interest rates if you're lucky on a savings account, or as I mentioned, that even less than that my max interest notion. And again, that this is less than inflation. But the crazy part is, if you look out to 10 years, the 10-year rate has been compressed so much from a year ago where it was close to 1.5%. Now it's barely trying to get around 0.6%. So locking your money up for 10 years, collecting interest rate, you're only going to get about 0.6%. Your money is going to be worth a good amount less than what you put into it after 10 years. So it doesn't seem like too great of a proposition.
So it sounds like it's the same idea as the cash. It's you're going to lose money to inflation, likely, but the key is this doesn't go down in value.
Yeah, so that's one thing to kind of realize when you're investing for the long term. You want to hopefully grow your money. You don't want to, when you think of an investment, you don't think that you're going to end up with less money. So when you're parking money in treasuries, it's quite possible that you'll get less out than you put in after you adjust for inflation, even if you have a 10, 20, 30 year horizon at this point. So the other thing to realize, though, is when you're investing and you do end up having an allocation to treasuries or bonds, you want to kind of match the duration of your investment horizon with the duration of the bonds themselves. Now, just one little caveat: when I talk about duration, it's a little technical, but it's not the actual time period of the treasury. For example, a 10-year treasury is not a 10-year duration. It's actually slightly less. The technical term for duration is just a mathematical formula that tells you what is the amount of time expected to get all of your money back, because you're getting interest slowly along the way. So if you have a 10-year investment horizon, you'll probably not want the 10-year treasury, but the 15-year treasury, something like that, or some weighted average of, you know, a 20-year and a 10-year would get you to that 15-year.
Okay. So if I remember correctly, would a zero coupon bond have a duration equal exactly to the maturity?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. So a zero coupon bond is a bond that doesn't pay interest over time. You lend the company or government money, they will pay you back a higher amount when that bond expires. So instead of getting a little bit of interest every 6 months or every year, you're going to get the entire amount back at the end. So because the normal bond, you're getting paid a little bit over time, that's why the duration is less than maturity, but if it's zero coupon, it means they're not paying interest over time. You get your entire amount of money back at the end, so your duration equals your maturity.
Right, and then you know, just the last bit, you're still going to have to pay your federal taxes, but you don't have to pay state or local on treasury. So there's a slight benefit there.
Yes. So, okay. So that's a good point, especially comes up with municipal bonds. We'll come into a little bit, but I do like your pointing out the time, the length of time, whether it is duration or maturity, because when we look at bonds, so again, moving next step up the risk return spectrum, they tend to be classified, the risks are classified on two spectrums or two variables. One is the credit quality of the company or agency or issuer, and the other is the duration. So we talk about treasuries are considered the safest in terms of credit quality. There is still some risk on the duration side. Once we move one step up, we combine these. So you might have things like highly rated companies. These would be AA and AAA by ratings agencies. So big companies with a lot of cash on hand that you've heard of. If Apple's trying to borrow money, if Berkshire Hathaway or Google's trying to borrow money, they have so much cash, their credit rating is so high that the risk of that company going bankrupt and then and that company defaulting on their loan is so low that it's considered as safe as a corporation can be. So that'd be a highly rated company. And if you're only borrowing it, or they're only borrowing it for 30 days, so again, that short term, the odds of you getting paid back are so high that this would be a very, very safe investment. You also could have the same highly rated company, but now they're trying to build a new headquarters, so they're going to borrow money and they're going to pay it back over 30 years. While they're really safe now, we don't know. We have seen companies fail on the scale of decades. So it is possible that if they have a decade worth of bad products and they start going downhill, that within 30 years they could default on that loan. So while it's unlikely, just adding that time risk makes the longer term borrowing riskier than the shorter term. On the other, as we go down the risk spectrum on the credit quality, you could also have companies that aren't as safe as the really big names, the Apple, Berkshire Hathaway, Google, but they're not necessarily bad. So you, there's a spectrum within that of credit qualities that different ratings agencies will use. So AAA, AA, single A, triple B, double B, B, C's, and then start getting to really higher risk borrowing. So you could have a riskier company, so they're rated double B, but it's only a 30-day borrowing that reduces the risk. So that might be okay. But if that double B company is borrowing for 10 or 30 years, they'll have to pay more in interest for investors to take on that risk than that AAA or AA company. So anytime we're looking at bonds, it's that combination of both credit quality of the issuer and duration or maturity of that length of time. So you can have, sometimes you'll see some opportunistic bond investors or bond investments. They might do things like low credit quality. So this is what's sometimes called junk bonds. If it gets low enough, you get low credit quality versus safer ones are called investment grade bonds. So you have investment grade or junk bonds. But if they do a short-term time frame, then that might be a way to reduce some of that risk. Where you do a low credit quality, short-term time frame, you might be able to get a little bit more yield than using a safer company. And by using the shorter time frame, you reduce some of the risk. But those low credit quality companies and a longer time frame, you might see something like somewhere between 5 and 20% of them are expected to fail. So you're taking on fairly significant default risk, the risk that this company goes bankrupt and they stop paying their debt obligations. So when you look at bonds and kind of understanding the risk of bonds, what are are there any other factors that you look at, Trishul?
Well, if you're someone like me who finds solace with a kind of passive strategy, but still would need a allocation for bonds, one thing to consider is just like how there is the S&P 500 index. Again, we haven't got into stocks, but that's just the broad market index of stocks. Mm-hmm. There's a broad market index of bonds that is also helpful to understand just how are bonds doing in the aggregate. And then, of course, you can buy a low-cost fund to mirror or try to match this broad market of bonds. So previously, this was known as Lehman Ag, and then Lehman got into some trouble. So now it's known as the Barclay Ag Index. So it's the aggregate index, AGG. So the aggregate index of bonds across these various riskiness and durations.
That's a good point. So a decent bond investment, whether it's a passive ETF or a active managed one, it will have a default rate, maybe on the scale of 1% or lower, depending on the riskiness that they're taking on. So that's kind of priced into these pooled investments that we'll have to get enough interest from all the bonds together, knowing that, say, we're going to lose 0.5% or less to default. So if you're looking at ETFs, you could also focus on safer bonds. And again, because they're safer, they're going to have lower interest rates. So they're going to pay you less. And if you wanted to take on more risk to try and get a better return, there are riskier versions. But yeah, the AGG, that Barclays Aggregate Bond Index, is a really good just default bond option. That if you don't want to have to learn about bond risks, just if that's your bond allocation, that's fine. What you could start to do is maybe do a corporate bond or a treasury bond. Treasuries tend to do a little bit better in recessions or market downturns. They have a better negative correlation. So sometimes if I was trying to do something very simple for a client, we might do, if it was a 60-40 portfolio, so 60% stocks, 40% bonds, within the bond side, we might do 30% in that aggregate index and 10% in treasuries. And there are times that the treasuries can help provide a little more security and can even go up while the stocks are going down. They've shown that negative correlation just a little bit better. But yeah, I like using the Barclays Aggregate Index. The exception might be, again, kind of moving next level up that risk return spectrum, might be municipal bonds. So municipal bonds are issued by state or local governments. So it could be a city that you're in. They want to build a new school, so they need to borrow the money to pay the construction workers and buy the land. And so they're going to sell bonds to raise enough cash. And through city revenues or state revenues, they're going to pay off these bonds over the next 30 years. Municipal bonds, again, state or local bonds, based on a Supreme Court ruling, are federally tax-free. So this is the big reason why there's a market for municipal bonds or muni bonds, is when you buy muni bonds, you don't pay federal income taxes on the interest of those bonds. And if you buy muni bonds for the state that you live in, I know at least for California, and I'm pretty sure it's for all the states that have a state income tax, they will say that the interest on local muni bonds is also state tax-free. So for California residents, in their taxable accounts, when we use bonds, we try to use California muni bonds as much as possible. And again, municipalities, they can't issue money like the U.S. government. They can tax, so they can raise revenue via laws, but so they're a little safer than some corporations because they can raise money via taxes, but they have still ratings that they have to worry about. They still have budgets. They still have entitlements that they have to pay attention to. And because they can't just issue more California dollars, they have to pay attention to that. So you can have concerns where a certain municipality may be higher risk than another municipality. So the balance sheets of these individual cities or states can come into play in terms of the credit quality risk. But if you have a relatively conservative strategy, you can get the California Muni Bond. I think Pennsylvania also has a Muni Bonds funds, because I think Pennsylvania has a state income tax that will be both federally tax-free, because all Muni Bonds are federally tax-free, and state income tax-free if you buy the Muni Bonds in your state. So a lot of the high state income tax states, most companies that offer Muni Bond funds, whether it's an ETF or a mutual fund, will offer a state-specific Muni Bond fund.
So based upon our just previous conversation around some of these topics, is if you have a taxable account, then certainly if you're a high marginal tax rate individual, you may consider the munis. But if you are in looking at a tax advantage account like your IRA or 401k or Roth and whatnot, then it might make sense to go with something more like the Lehman Ag, something that you don't care about those taxes. And again, the taxes are kind of a big deal, because you're talking about taxes on interest when you talk about bonds, and that's at your ordinary income tax rate. So it's the higher tax rate that you would pay.
Yeah, and that's actually a really good point. Your marginal tax rate does matter, because all the investors and the municipalities know that everyone gets these tax benefits. For the same level of risk, if you have a corporation that's rated A and a municipality that's rated A, the muni can offer a lower interest rate and still get the same level investment, because they know everyone investing in that gets the tax-free benefit. And so when you're comparing corporate bonds to muni bonds, there's a tax equivalent yield where, based on your individual marginal tax rate, you can figure out which one makes more sense. So it's not always a perfectly safe assumption that muni bonds are better than taxable accounts. I would say that you want taxable, especially corporate bonds, in your retirement accounts, because we don't care that those interest rates are growing. We just want the highest interest rate relative to the level of risk we're taking on. But there are some times where if your tax rate is low enough, you don't necessarily gain the benefits of those muni bonds because they're paying less in interest. You would actually get the higher, you'd rather get the higher corporate interest rates and pay taxes on that because your tax rate's relatively low. So it's not always a perfectly safe assumption. There's math to do that. It's called the taxable equivalent yield. But for high marginal tax rates, muni bonds make a lot of sense in taxable accounts. Corporate bonds make a lot of sense in retirement accounts.
Yep, sounds good.
Okay. Anything else you want to add on the bond side? Have you ever played around with junk bonds?
I'm pausing for a moment because I had a hedge fund strategy for that, but I guess I could talk about that now. I did. I used to have a strategy that traded various types of high-risk bonds, for sure.
Okay. And what were some of your observations?
It's period-specific. It's one of those things where there are times when it looks great, and a lot of the times they may look okay, but when they look bad, they look really bad. So it's just like any strategy, you got to weigh those risks and returns. And it's not something I would probably consider for my portfolio, that is, or for most people I would invest with.
Okay. So as we move up from junk bonds and those high risk bonds, I think I'm trying to think like the safest side on the stock side. So you're now kind of moving from debt or fixed income to the equity, to the ownership side, where at the very, very basic level, if a company goes bankrupt, the bond holders, the debt holders get paid out first before any equity owners. So that's kind of why, in general, bonds are safer than stocks. That if the company is going bankrupt, bond holders are more likely to get their money back, or at least some of their money back, and stockholders or the owners are less likely to get money back and probably get nothing back. So with junk bonds and those high risk bonds, you're kind of playing that odds of that company going bankrupt game that you do play with stock that, yeah, I guess there's going to be more volatility because if this company does well, it'll pay off the interest on this bond. But if it does poorly, you're going to lose your money just barely before, or you might get slightly bit more if you own stock in that high risk company. So when I think of the safest thing on the stock side, I tend to think of preferred stock first. This is still technically ownership, so it's stock, but because it's preferred, it does get paid out before common stockholders. So that's the one aspect that gives it slightly less risk than a common stockholder. So if you go to open a brokerage account and you want to buy shares of Apple, you'll be buying common stock. So there are preferred stock markets and you can find them, but it's a little bit like buying bonds or individual bonds. Preferred stock also usually has a consistent dividend. So it's one of those things where it's still technically ownership, but it looks and feels more like a bond. It's going to pay out a more consistent dividend. You aren't going to see significant appreciation on their preferred stock because most of the profits are paid out, and it does get paid out. If the company goes bankrupt, preferred stockholders get paid out before common stockholders. So that tends to be the transition from the safer bonds to the riskier stocks, is the high risk bonds are definitely not safe, but they would technically get paid out before stockholders. The preferred stockholders are also not safe, but not as risky as common stock. So this I don't see very much. Every now and then I'll come across someone who has some, but it's kind of in the middle. I've seen some strategies that were using this as a middle strategy. They felt that the risk of stocks wasn't being paid off correctly, that the risk was too high and preferred stock was the best risk-adjusted return. Do you see any strategies that use preferred stock much? Or have you done so in the past?
It's probably just for the reasons you mentioned. And you might be slightly more on the sophistication scale if you're dabbling in this place. So in general, though, there might be also a benefit of having a higher dividend. And as Aaron, you had mentioned, the dividend is more likely to occur for the preferred than the common.
Okay. So that's a good point. So even if it's a stable company that is issuing a dividend, if the company's in trouble, they might stop the dividend on the common shares, but not stop the dividend on the preferred shares.
Right. And I also believe that if the preferreds don't get their dividends, once they restart dividends, the preferreds need to get their catch-up dividends before the commons can get any.
Oh, interesting. That's a good point. I had forgotten that, but you're right. That's another reason why preferred stocks are less risky, but also because they're less risky, there's less appreciation. The reward benefit is not as high.
Right. Now, of course, there's no free lunch with common or preferred, so you're trading off one thing for another, but you're not guaranteed to be better off with one thing or another, meaning with the preferred, you may have over the longer term a higher dividend, but less in terms of actual total return, or about the same in terms of total return as if you invested in the common.
I would, in general, yeah. So it's preferred stocks are lower on the risk return spectrum. So I'd say it is both lower expected risk. And I would say it's lower expected return.
You're right. Actually, what I meant to say is your risk adjusted return should be about the same.
Yes, I agree with that. Risk adjusted return should be about the same. And because preferred stock is lower risk, therefore it's lower expected return.
Right.
Okay. So moving up after preferred stock, when we start looking at just the general stock space. This is kind of all that different valuations, international. What would you say is kind of safest? Again, that's, now we're starting to like use the air quotes of like really comparing to the riskier stuff. But among the stocks, what is the lower risk stock investments?
Well, typically what they say is having a basket of stocks, but they also tend to think, and this is debatable, that value stocks might be a little safer than growth stocks because these are companies that have been around for a while. That's debatable in terms of, are you getting a better or a higher return off of one versus the other if you look at longer term trends. But in general, if you look at more bigger, more established companies, there's reasons to believe that these might be more safe.
Okay. So big established companies, does that tend to imply large cap, or could you have big established companies that aren't large caps companies?
It roughly implies a large cap. You know, you think about the Dow 30, these are stocks of pretty big companies that have been around for a pretty long time and there's pretty low turnover in that index.
Okay. So large companies that have been around for a long time, again, still lots of volatility. Again, if you look at the stock market and you look at the Dow, you'll still see a lot of ups and downs, but these would be considered the lower risk among the stocks that you could invest in.
Yeah. And I guess the reason I'm hedging quite a bit when I'm saying this is because, you know, certainly if you have one stock within the Dow 30, then that idiosyncratic risk we've mentioned a couple of times come up. There could be an issue that strives and hits that one stock, and all of a sudden you could get wiped out.
Okay, that's a really good point. So maybe one large cap company would still be riskier than a diversified pool of a slightly riskier asset class.
Yeah, and the other reason I'm hedging is you look at the correlation of the Dow and then the S&P 500, which is the 500 largest companies, and it's just such a high correlation that they're pretty much mimicking each other.
Okay, so the S&P 500 might be safer or less risky than the Dow because we are reducing that concentration. And we're more diversified, but still getting most of that large established company benefit.
Yeah. And, you know, you kind of plot the two on top of each other. And over shorter periods, they'll look pretty similar. They might go back and forth over some longer periods. But overall, it's hard to say that you'll have a better after-tax or risk-adjusted total return by investing in one versus the other.
Okay. So after large cap, so after U.S. domestic large cap, would you say something like international developed, international large cap, U.S. mid cap or small cap? What would you think would be the next level of riskier?
So I think once we start pulling in international, we're kind of trading off risks here. So it's hard to say exactly. So when we think about international, we are looking at developed and emerging. And if you actually compare, you know, U.S. to non-U.S. as an aggregate, what you notice is over time, there could be stretches of period where the U.S. does well. And over time, there could be other stretches of period where the international markets do well. And if you just kind of think about it, there shouldn't be a statistical edge for either region in terms of performance of a given stock or market. Meaning if the U.S. always did better, then more people would invest in the U.S. The prices of the U.S. stocks would be higher. And then on a forward basis, those returns would be lower because things were just priced accordingly or efficiently. So overall, an investment within a U.S. broad market versus the rest of the world broad market should be about the same in terms of risk-adjusted returns. So that's kind of how I see it. And if you're talking about the second part to your question of, well, what if you looked at mid-caps in the U.S. versus large caps and or smaller companies than even mid-caps? Well, there may be some sort of premium in terms of reward, meaning you have more riskier companies, so you should have a higher return. But when you adjust for the fact that these companies are more risky, your risk-adjusted return may actually be about the same.
Okay. So when I tend to put international, even developed countries, so very large established economies, and even the large cap companies within developed countries. So I think one of the classic examples might be Nestle is a Swiss company, I believe. And this is a very large established company. And so it might have similar risk return characteristics as, say, Coca-Cola in the US. I do wonder, like, is there any currency risk that in play there? Do you see that play out over time, or is that kind of also even out and you see ebbs and flows?
Well, so currency on its own is technically a bucket or an asset class that you can think about. But one thing to realize about currency is if one currency goes up, the other currency goes down. So it's one of the true zero-sum games in investing, meaning there's always a winner and a loser tied to a trade, such that if you're betting on a currency because you think this currency is going to do better, being right more than 50% of the time is going to be quite challenging. These are very large and quite efficient markets. So over time, it's hard to say, but there is a risk for your home currency because of one specific thing. If you live in the US, for example, you need to make your purchases in USD. So that's something to realize when you have investments that are international. If those currencies end up going sideways, then that could hurt you. Of course, it could help you as well. But I kind of feel like it's a coin toss in which way it would go. But if you're susceptible to that risk and that risk is a concern, you know, that's something you have to be aware about, at least.
Okay. So could you benefit on the upside based on that currency risk?
Oh, yeah, for sure. So if you're investing and the US dollar values, then the currency might help you. Or if it devalues, it could hurt you.
Okay. So again, looking at kind of common stock in large established companies, large cap within the US, then international developed companies, especially large cap. Say the next level is probably looking at small cap companies, kind of both domestic, so US small cap companies wouldn't have the currency risk, then developed economies, but small cap companies in those developed economies. So that also might be kind of the next tier of risk. Would you agree with that, Trishul?
Yeah, that makes sense. And again, there's just an inherent level of riskiness as you get small in size, just because these companies have less resources to outlast a business cycle where there could be tremendous disruption. In addition to idiosyncratic risks that are more likely to affect a small company where they don't have the levers to pull to quickly pull in a new CEO or quickly shift product lines and things like that, that a larger company may be able to do. So again, you may expect a higher return, but it's hard to say that once you compensate for risk that you might get a higher risk adjusted return.
Have we seen that play out over time where small caps have outperformed large caps?
We have, and there's always been this notion that there's a small cap bias. It's a notion that, yeah, small caps should do better over time for that riskiness reason. But if everybody knows this, again, there's that catch 22 of, okay, if everybody knows that small caps are going to do better, what are they going to do? They're going to buy more small caps. And again, we're stuck with this notion that, okay, if they're buying more small caps, the small caps are going to be more expensive than they used to be. So then you would expect to earn a lower return on something that costs more to get into.
Okay. So large cap, international developed, large cap within international developed, then we have small caps, both domestic and within international developed. And I keep using international developed because that's a good way to distinguish between international and emerging markets, that these would be developing countries where the economies are growing, but maybe not as stable. Could you give us a quick primer on emerging markets as economies and then also investing in stocks in emerging markets?
Right. So these are markets in countries where they have less stability for political reasons. Their governments may not be as stable. They might have less stability for just monetary policy reasons. And there could be reasons why inflation could be high in these countries due to excess spending. Interest rates may be higher, so that's something to think about. But in general, the notion is these countries are trying to grow and they're trying to develop very quickly, but they might be taking on a lot of risk along the way, and they might stumble as well. So there have been periods where you've seen pretty high returns for some of these countries, and it's been kind of great. But then you've also seen pretty long stretches where things became so overpriced. Again, a lot of investors ran to these countries thinking, oh, great, such a high return, such that the returns for their last decade or so have been kind of mediocre, even though the risk has been higher. So over longer term averages, again, things have a way of equaling out so that you can't just say this place has a higher return, let me go chase that and hope for the best and expect to get it.
There's this one brochure like showing clients every now and then. It shows kind of returns by asset class in each calendar year. And one of the things that's kind of interesting to point out, emerging markets equity is almost always at the very top or the very bottom. So you get things like in 2008, emerging markets was negative 53%. It was the worst thing. Then in 2009, emerging markets was plus 79%. It was the best thing. And this has played out quite a bit over the last 20 years or so, I guess, however long we've been viably investing in emerging markets as an asset class.
Yeah, and what I kind of encourage people to do, looking at, you know, a color chart like that, where you have all these different buckets across different time periods, is it's kind of hard to come up with a predictable pattern that, besides understanding something maybe more risky in terms of picking what will be the next winner for the following year. And this is something that professionals try to do all the time, and it's a very hard problem to do. And that's kind of why I encourage to just kind of spread your bets across the entire planet. That's why I think a globally diversified portfolio across all these various stock and bond buckets is kind of sensible.
Okay. So after emerging markets, again, as a kind of still diversified index or diversified fund, I tend to point out to clients that this is where I like to put investing in a single company. I actually consider any single stock, I kind of consider riskier than any diversified asset class. Maybe not emerging markets, but again, it kind of depends on the individual stocks. Maybe a single large cap company might be safer than an emerging markets index, maybe, but a single small cap stock might be riskier. But yeah, single stocks, again, I'd say is always riskier. I'd be curious. So a couple of things I've written down and now I think about it, I'm not quite sure where I put them in. I have things like emerging markets debt. So you said this was, should be safer than emerging markets stock, but because the emerging markets have so many concerns at the government and monetary level, where would you kind of fit these in a little bit? Would these be maybe on the junk bond side?
Perhaps. I think at this point we get to things that fall under or outside the bread and butter category and end up in the more exotic bucket. If you're kind of treading in these waters, you're probably looking for something a little more spicy and juicy. And it might be something that hopefully doesn't represent a large percent of the pie, but if you feel like, you know, going to Vegas for a little bit, that's where I'd kind of put these things. So I'd say it's comparable to your casino money.
Okay. So again, that buying stocks for fun money, that if you're going to pick a single stock,
yeah,
go ahead and pick some emerging markets debt.
Yeah. And then as far as the specific instrument you play in, if it's a bond, you can hopefully find some sort of rating agency to put a number behind it. Of course, you can't go off of that alone. And then if it's a stock, you might, or a fund that operates in one of these categories, you can use some sort of style box, like for Morningstar, where they have a spectrum of, you know, risky to non-risky. That might help as well. But again, it's hard to use these metrics to come up with a predictable way to outsmart the market. So I feel like you might also you know, put these names on a wall, stand back 10 feet and throw a couple darts.
What about other alternatives like commodities or currencies?
Right. So I mentioned before that with currencies, you're kind of talking a zero-sum game, and you might dabble in this space if you think you have some sort of knowledge that the market is not pricing in. And again, to do this consistently is quite challenging. I used to sell currency options, meaning I used to sell these things to people who thought they could find an edge. And it was so rare that somebody was able to find an edge, and incredibly rare that somebody was able to find an edge that they could sustain it for long periods of time. I did something similar by used to sell commodity options as well. And if you look at long-term commodity prices, they don't do too much better than inflation. So there could be micro periods where you see large swings. You know, we saw large swings with oil recently. We're seeing large swings with gold every now and then. But the concern is if you look at long averages, you may not do better than certainly a broad diversified portfolio of stocks, and you may not even outperform inflation.
I like the kind of chucking at the idea that we're going to add in all the volatility of stocks and get the long-term average of inflation, which is back around our treasury return.
Right. And, you know, it's just that appeal. You see, you know, on, is CNBC still around? Bloomberg or whatever is on the news these days where, you know, gold is up 20% in the last month or oil is down 50%. These numbers just sound exciting and enticing, but it's just important to realize if you look at long-term averages, you're talking about investing here, that it may be more of a speculation than an actual investment strategy that's strategic in nature.
I'll point out to clients that gold is the common one. It's similar to Bitcoin in terms of my philosophy is that with all the other companies, all the stocks you're buying, these are companies that are generating revenues and they're paying out these revenues and profits to the owners, whether it's via dividends or via stock price appreciation. With gold or Bitcoin, there's no inherent or intrinsic value. It's just you're hoping someone will pay you more in the future than you paid today. That there's just the thing, and there's no particular reason why it should increase in value. Now, this kind of gets into a fiat currency discussion we talked about with modern monetary theory, is that that would be the argument that gold has been a store of value over multiple millennia. So sort of, but again, that's also why you see long-term returns pretty close to inflation. That is just going to be about the same amount of value over time would be the expectation, but it takes a lot of risk to get that.
Right. And the other big bucket that we kind of see is real estate. And we did a whole episode on that. So we covered a lot of bases there. But I just say for the average household, they likely will have an allocation to real estate just because they might own a house that they live in.
Mm-hmm. Real estate, I agree. That's something we probably should spend more time on. But that has characteristics similar to equities, and that you are ownership and you can lose everything. There's also, especially for rental real estate, characteristics similar to bonds because it does have that higher regular yield. So the total return of real estate is a combination of appreciation plus rental income. So maybe it's similar to like a preferred stock, or you're combining the risk of a preferred stock with that individual equity, that individual stock, which is super risky. So yeah, it's different, but it is incorporating a few of the risks we've talked about. And the last one I want to kind of mention before we run out of time is the leverage that mortgages provide for real estate is very similar to the leverage that options have. And so that's why I tend to put options kind of at the far end of the risk return spectrum, where you have all of those risks associated with owning single stocks, but now you're amplifying it both up and down, where if it does well, you're going to do amazingly well. But if it does poorly or even just not well, you'll be underperforming or even losing money. So you could be in a situation where the stock value is going up, but it's going up slowly. And so you don't get enough appreciation on the stock for your options to make up for the cost of the options. So I tend to put that farther out because now you're adding leverage, which is why you see the risk associated with real estate and the risk associated with options is that leverage component makes it even riskier than just owning the single stock or owning the property.
Right. And just a few tidbits I throw in with the options is the good part about options is you can control your gearing or your leverage by your moneyness. So we talked about if you're in the money, meaning are you able to, does a stock option itself have intrinsic value? Is the actual price above the strike? Well, if you're far out of the money, meaning the actual stock price is far below the strike, you have a higher leverage, meaning if you actually end up being in the money, you have multiples of what you paid for in terms of the premium you put in. But as you go further in the money, well, then it starts to kind of approximate the riskiness of a stock, meaning if your strike is close to zero and the stock is way in the money, then you have basically the riskiness of buying the actual stock itself. So you get to decide the level of risk return you want when you're buying an option, which I don't recommend.
Yeah. I'm trying to think, is there a way to use an option to reduce the risk of the individual stock? I guess you could use fewer options to get the same dollar value as the stocks, but you're investing less money to get the same risk return. So maybe that's the way to do it. Where instead of if I have $1,000 and I'm buying all stock or $1,000 buying all options, my $1,000 in options is amplified significantly, but I can probably mimic the $1,000 of stock with $200 or $300 of options.
So at the end of the day, even though you can adjust your gearing, in fact, if you buy some puts and you hold the stock, you could reduce the downside risk, but then you're giving up upside gains because you're spending money on the puts themselves. So there are ways to combine stocks or just use options on their own instead of combining them with stocks to come up with a profile that can kind of suit what you're going for. But at the end of the day, there's no reason why you should get a better risk-adjusted return. This is what I just keep coming back to with all of these different styles. Because, you know, why do something if you're getting more risk for less return, you know?
So
given that, you may not do better, but I can certainly show you a million ways that you can try.
So also going back to our final thought last week of if we focus on asset allocation, let's try and target that we call the efficient frontier of risk return. Can we get better return for the same amount of risk? Can we get the same return for less risk? And if we get things on that return where it's just where this is all kind of the same risk adjusted return, then it's just personal preference, it almost feels like.
Yeah, I kind of see that. So our goal is to first figure out what's a good target level of risk we're comfortable with for a given situation. Mm-hmm. And then after that, we want to say, okay, how can we maximize that return for that level of risk? And then once we maximize that, it typically involves allocating across a few of these buckets to figure out what makes sense for a client. So that's how it kind of works in practice.
I like that. I like that kind of final thought that the risk of what you need the money for and both risk tolerance and time frame is the more important factor. And then how do we fill in the investments to line up with those risks that you're targeting?
Right. Yep. That sounds like it kind of wraps it up. So thanks, Aaron. I really enjoyed the conversation.
This was fun. I really appreciate your input, Trishul.
Thanks. And thanks, everybody, for listening. Have a good one, Aaron.
Bye.
Bye.
We appreciate you joining us today for this episode of the Mind Money Spectrum podcast. Be sure to visit mindmoneyspectrum.com to access the entire library of episodes. Remember, it's not black and white, but the wide spectrum of gray area where you get to pursue the freedoms you want in life. Opinions voiced in this material are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. All performance referenced is historical and is no guarantee of future results. All indices are unmanaged and may not be invested in directly. Have a nice day.